Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts. I'm Cap from Nerdy Show.
I'm Brian. I do the writing.
I'm Scott. I do the art.
And this is Volume 7, Issue 4 of Atomic Robo and the She-Devils of the Pacific.
They got jetpacks.
Sure do. If you haven't listened to previous episodes, you're probably going to be scratching your head. This show is basically an audio commentary of the Atomic Robo series, which is a comic book with pictures, and this is all the insider information. It's like, say you put your Laserdisc in the Laserdisc player and you know, press the buttons and got an audio commentary from a director. How weird is that, right? This is like that thing, but on a computer.
What's a Laserdisc player?
I didn't follow any of that.
It's from the future. No. It's like a movie on a CD.
from the future of 1986, yes.
Well, now that we've discussed the future, let's dial all the way back to 1945, where the issue opens up. Specifically, September 3rd, 1945. The day of Japanese surrender, I assume.
Yes.
Probably.
Correct.
Should really open a script here so I know what's going on.
this will mark the very first time Scott has read the script.
Page 1, panel 1. There's some interesting ideas you have here, Brian.
Thank you. I like what you drew.
It looks like I might have accidentally incorporated them into my art.
Oh.
Excellent. So where do we go? Here we are, 1945, September 3rd.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of the background information on our Chokaitan villains. Why? What do they do? What's happening?
Well, let me ask you this. Chokaitan, is this the first time we've seen that phrase, I believe, in the this volume so far. Was that actually the name of the secret projects, or was that something that you devised?
No, it is something that I slightly devised from the guy who translates my scripts for Gurihiru. They're a Japanese art team, and I've done a couple of comics with them. And I was like, hey, we're working on this thing, and there's going to be some Japanese supervillains. So, hey, you're a great guy to be talking to, Mr. Japanese guy. Help me out with some translations. There was a group of Japanese, I forget if they were a platoon or if it was just a program or what, just called Kaiten. It basically meant the Heaven Shakers or Earth Changers, something like that.
I like Heaven Shakers. That sounds awesome.
It's pretty badass. So that's
yes, it is.
That's why I use the word. But I wanted this to be something more than that. So Chokaiten apparently means the Great Heaven Shakers. and the real Kaiten was an elite group used, I think it's the guy, those are the guys who, they were like man-piloted missiles, and they would suicide bomb. So yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
It is.
Chokaiten is a little bit better in that they don't intentionally suicide themselves, but maybe they do.
They're totally capable of it. They're prepared.
Yeah, so Brian just said draw a giant super carrier under construction. And I was like, oh, I hate your guts. Okay.
But it turned out really nice. Look at that.
I was pretty happy with the way it came out. Yeah. Yeah.
You got your cables, got your Wegener devices.
I got giant robot arms doing things. So it's all right.
But tell me about this big big thrusty engine in the back. Make it look like a Batmobile.
It's actually the front. I guess it doesn't really matter one way or the other, but I don't actually have an explanation of anything we're looking at. That is the reactor, I guess. I don't know. Part of the engine for... did we reveal its secret in this issue, Brian? I think we do, right?
No, we don't.
Yes, we do, on page 19. Yeah, so I can say it. So that is the engine that drives the anti-grav engines on this thing. Spoilers, hope you read this before you listen to the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, well, one would hope. One would hope. Dude, I only read Atomic Robo while I'm listening to Nuts and Bolts, so I can get page-by-page dissection as I'm experiencing it for the first time. Isn't that the optimal way to experience Atomic Robo?
That's pretty hardcore. That might be.
No. That sounds like a terrible idea. Don't do it. If you're doing it right now,
We could do like an audio book and then get like a little boop at the end of the page, like sign up for the page. That'd be sweet. We could read our comics to our fans, Brian.
Brian's got that mentally handicapped voice he does. It's a classic.
This is just my voice.
That's his normal voice.
That was a low blow.
That's special for the radio audience.
All right, so we've got this flashback. It's all got this this sort of washed tone over it, and we get the motivation of this secret group of Japanese super weapon powered dudes.
Yeah, we figured by issue 4, maybe we should have told everybody why these guys exist in the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had me asking the questions all throughout the previous episodes, and you know, you guys are just choking me of wait and see, wait and see. So here we are.
That's how we get you.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't feel like you waited too long, though. I mean, I know there were a lot of reviews of issue 3. They were like, whoa, nothing happened this issue.
Except for all the explosions.
Except for all the action. Blowing up, you whiners. I mean, a bunch of stuff happened. But yeah, I know what they mean. Like, there was no exposition. And you can't say there wasn't plot development. There was plot development.
There was, yeah, some very, very important things happened.
Yeah, didn't we blow up an island last issue?
Kind of did.
That was last issue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's big.
Yeah. And of course, you got the way you guys create Robo as they're presented as self-contained stories. You read them issue by issue because you want to get it as soon as possible, but really it's all about the full experience. So you can't really weigh a single issue on pacing alone because it won't make sense until you have the whole thing in front of you.
Yeah, that's correct. Like volume 2 was like that. And no one liked it until it was over, and then they liked it. Volume three, I think we pulled it off.
That is hard to do consistently.
Yes. Volume 5, I think we heard some complaints about that also. But yeah, when it's not a volume where it's a series of one-shot stories, of course you're going to have to wait. It's a story arc. You're going to have to be a little patient and read it again as a whole when you're done, I guess. I don't know. I always have to do it with comics anyway, because by the time the trade finally comes out or the last issue of an arc, I don't remember what the 15 pages I read, you know, 4 months ago were about. I got to read it all over again. So yes, we get the flashback. Yeah.
You guys had implied in the previous episodes, you know, oh well, the Japanese are really fascinated with what Tesla was working on, but then I guess here we have them outright stating a bit more than you guys did earlier, which is that it is, in fact, this entire operation is fueled by Tesla-inspired technology.
Yeah, we've kind of turned Tesla into this accidental figure of super weapons in the history of Robo's world, where, you know, he just has these crazy ideas. And he sort of historically was like this. He didn't really think about how these things would actually be used. Like, he just had a very naive view of humanity in a sense. Like, when he was promoting the idea of, oh, well, every nation will just have death rays and that will end all war because it would be too horrendous. No, Tesla, that's not how that works. That was literally nuclear weapons, and you could say that it ended nuclear war because they were too horrendous, but we also nearly destroyed the Earth several times.
Well, and there's still plenty of time to blow ourselves up. I mean,
exactly. So, you know, he was a genius in some ways, didn't quite know or figure out people or international politics in other ways.
Yeah.
So he puts out these ideas, you know, in Robo's world, you know, lightning guns, this, earthquake machines, that, and other people kind of latch onto these ideas, and other organizations with perhaps less moral viewpoints of, you know, how to use these technologies. And, you know, they retro engineer or steal or whatever, and we get things like Majestic 12 or the Chokaitan guys here.
But the earthquake bomb was actually a thing during World War II.
Yes.
But it was a British thing.
Do tell.
So early in World War II, the British were looking for things that would deliver crushing blows to end things quickly because they were not ready for war. I think the deal had something to do with, like, because bombing was so inaccurate, they figured, well, if we just had something that just did so much damage that it, like, it screwed things up at a geological level, it would just, you know, you would just hit somewhere in the city and you would destroy most of it. But that's all I can really remember about it at the moment. You know what? I bet Wikipedia could help out anyone who really wanted to know more.
I think it's just chock full of facts.
It is.
And so it was in no way inspired by the not particularly well-known Tesla incident where he accidentally created an earthquake in New York, or is still to this day rumored to have, but not really.
Yeah,
confirmed.
I don't know about that. I mean, because there is a fault line that runs right through Manhattan. So, you know, did he do anything? Did it just happen? You know, was it a natural occurring earthquake? Was it a coincidence? Who the hell knows?
Yeah, something to keep in mind about Tesla is that, yeah, he was a genius and, yeah, he did some incredible things, but he was also an amazing showman and he knew how to sell an idea to an audience, not necessarily to make any kind of vast fortune, though. The real Japanese army of World War II did experiment with death ray technology and earthquake weaponry, inspired by news stories promoted, you know, by Nikola Tesla and others before the war, because they felt it would be a more viable, a more easily developed technology than the thus far unproven, entirely theoretical technology of atomic weaponry. It just so happens that the Japanese were wrong. They were right to think that. They were just wrong.
Well, you see on page three here, I forgot we had talked about this because it's been so long since we recorded the last one, but there's only one Power Armor guard now, and he's not wearing his helmet. because I just didn't feel like drawing that anymore.
I hate this helmet.
And I feel like the overall demeanor of the power armor figure has sort of changed. Like, it looks... I mean, I know you say you just didn't... You straight up didn't like it, but it seems like the way the power armor guy carries himself in the background has a bit more intensity than the almost just kind of crazy robot-looking things that assaulted Robo when he got inside the sub.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is just... This is one of those things that I didn't have time to figure out before I had to draw it. So the first panel where you see them is pretty much the first time I ever drew them. So it's sort of like it evolves as it moves through the panels because I'm figuring things out. It's like, oh, this would look better. Oh, that would look better. So trying to keep it basically the same, but also making small changes to satisfy my own weird obsessive compulsive needs.
And it's an interesting parallel because only just now are the Japanese actually, they're kind of leading the way in the field of power armor. The U.S. are working on it plenty, but they're actually interested in practical applications a lot more than we are, and they're doing it as part of the tsunami cleanup, actually. So,
well, they got their start here.
Obviously. Yeah, right?
In our comic. Yeah, 100% accurate.
I just like it any time Robo talks to a guard.
Yes.
That's it. Just because it always, I don't know.
You just like it any time Robo talks to a guard?
Any opportunity I have where I'm like, oh, Robo's going to talk to these guards, like before in the previous issue, where he's just yapping at them and they don't say anything because they're guards. They don't want to strike up a conversation. They just want to point guns at him and make him go places. But this one just shoots him.
Something that that confused me, I guess, we'll be confronting pretty soon. He gets shot with this ion cannon.
Yes,
and it's got this yellow blast, and then he gets shot with a different ion cannon, and it wakes him up.
That's not my fault. I think it just has the effect of kind of switching him on and off accidentally.
This is what it is. This is how it
There's
works.
Science here, wait.
This is the science here. All right. You know how... All right, I even have a specific example that you should all know. Did you ever see that episode of The Flintstones?
Oh.
Where Fred gets hit in the head and he turns into Frederick?
Yes.
All right, yes, exactly. Follow me. I'm not done yet. About. Don't get ahead. Don't get ahead.
Okay.
All right, later on he gets hit in the head again. He turns back to regular Fred. That's what happens.
Okay. All right, I see.
That is literally the logic at work here.
Considering that he's some kind of mysteriously powered autonomous sentient robot, I will accept it.
The magic of Robo is that you can shoot him with any kind of energy weapon, and it can have any kind of effect. As we saw in Volume 2, it knocked him out and just slowly kind of revived himself. You know,
who knows
how electricity works? It's magic.
Oh, man. Red kryptonite.
Yeah.
Can't wait till Robo gets a lion head.
Red electricity will do that to you.
The Japanese did seem to perfect interior lighting on submarines.
Yes.
all the interiors of the Hida are all like, you know, bright white. Looks real cool. Man, you know, Das Boot.
As long as you don't think too hard about it, yeah.
No, because they watched Star Trek Next Generation first.
Exactly. Nick, our colorist, just thought it would be a good contrast to the kind of the dirty, earthy tones of all the She-Devil stuff. And so, yes, logically, it does not make sense that a submarine would be super well lit like this. But
it looks neat.
Yeah, it looks neat, and it creates a good contrast between, you know, oh, we're in the good guy's environment. Oh, we're in the bad guy's environment.
I really like the interior color design of the Hida because it's very unique for a villain environment. It's extremely stark, and especially with the new colorist on board, you have every time there's like an exterior shot, there's so many really great alternate levels of color, and it's very vibrant and all that. And so when you go to the interiors of the Hida, it's a really good contrast to basically everything else that's been happening in this volume so far.
I like the blues.
One of the areas that he and I are still trying to find a middle ground on is coloring machinery and technology. I prefer everything to have some color. Because Robo is just very gray and dull, I prefer other robots and machines and stuff to not be gray and dull for fear of them just blending a little too much. So, I mean, if you flip back to page one real quick, even with the sepia tones, originally it was all clean and white, and it kind of looked a bit like the interior of the ship. But I kind of cajoled Nick into dropping some dirty textures on the robot arms and giving them a color and giving the ship some color. So it's real subtle. And that's exactly what I want, is like real subtle, just something to help create a little, to break up the line work. And on page eight, his first pass anyway, and I'll see if it's still there in the PDF, there's the engine hoist that they hook Robo up to. It's like this crazy Fruit Loop orange colored thing. and it's quite hideous. I'm hoping.
The version I'm looking at, it's still orange, but I mean, it looks natural.
Yeah, the orange is kind of toned down. This is like a kind of like a pumpkin-y orange in this PDF.
Yes, I would describe it as a pumpkin-y orange.
Yes, the original one is not pumpkin-y. Much more. It's still too orange, but it's like, well, you got to ask yourself, is it really important? No, it is not. I don't know. We're still kind of messing around with stuff like that, trying to figure out the right balance. Because what Nick does, he does a lot of these really great shading effects and almost kind of reflections when he does the machinery. You can see it throughout all the aircraft he's drawn in the previous issues, even on Robo to a certain degree. Just the way he shades is very, I don't know quite how to put it, but he ends up reflecting colors. And so everything's kind of chrome in his head, and then it reflects the colors around it, and it works, but it's not quite the aesthetic I want for what we're doing.
So I hope you're listening, Nick, because you're fired.
No. No, not fired.
Shut up, Brian.
No. I really like Nick's work. He and I have been talking back and forth through the whole process of this first volume together and kind of trying to find our middle ground on things and figure out when he says one thing, how I interpret it, and how when I give, when I say do this, he might interpret it different from the way I mean it. The problem is there's so much different terminology that means the same thing in comics and art. And there's no, like, you don't go to school per se to learn how to make, well, you can go to school to make comics, but most of us don't. And most of us didn't go to school to learn to color comics. So you figure everything out on your own and create your own methods for getting someplace. So I'm finding with Nick, it's very easy to say, all right, this is the emotion I want, or this is what I want this panel to feel like. And he's really good at getting to the same place in his own way.
Yeah, well, like in scenes like, say, page 11, where the She-Devil's attack is in full swing and they're basically firing out of the panel there, the color offers so much more depth than it has been in previous volumes, really. You can see the action a little bit more vividly because of the shadows and so on that he gives. So I'm definitely liking this transition.
Yeah, and it's all constantly changing. He's been, as they start to come out in print, we're seeing the difference between how we thought it was going to look and how it did actually look. There's a couple, I think on the flashback pages in this issue, we did a little experiment with the pencils. If you look at the flashback pages, the first two, and then there's one later on here. Well, let's move forward. Let's not move back. Page 13. Now, obviously, everything's done in a kind of sepia tone sort of thing because it's another flashback as Hazel recounts how she followed Robo and whatnot. But what Nick didn't do, I believe, what he didn't do to the line work is darken it up any, because I darken and clean everything up when I format the pages and send them in, and he's been darkening them even further. And I thought something was a little off, but I didn't know what it was. So we had a conversation about, will it print all muddy or will it print too faint if we don't do this second level of darkening things up? And I don't think Rhonda was doing anything like that previously, but I don't know. So we're experimenting here with not, I believe, the idea was to not darken them anymore and see how they printed, if the line work was still clear. Because the pencils, even when they are darkened up, they are still kind of brownish gray and not a perfect, like, inked black.
Right, and just, like, filling everybody who's listening in, if we've mentioned it in previous episodes, but if you didn't pick up on it, there's no inking phase in Robo anymore. Scott draws it all in the sharpest pencils you've ever seen and then scans it and darkens it, and that's what you get on page. That's the line work.
Yeah. And so if we end up just going with that in future volumes, it will kind of change the way he colors things, because he'll have to pick softer palettes to go with the softer pencils, which I'm still back and forth on myself. I do like a nice soft pencil line, but I also prefer it with like a Ben Caldwell kind of sketchier way of drawing things. So I don't know yet. But on this page, you can see example of both. The last two panels, the pencils have gone through a second process of being darkened up a bit.
It is maybe just a stark contrast between the sepia panels and this being one being fainter than the other, but it does seem like extremely thick, vivid. Everything about those two panels at the bottom are just like bright, neon even.
Yes. Yeah. So I need to decide I guess we have a little bit of time here as we wrap up this volume and before we start the next one. So he and I need to get together and decide what's going to work best and where we want it to go permanently, I guess. This one was everything was so kind of rushed and messed up starting. It was just kind of like, just kind of color them however you want. Here's my basic ideas and we'll edit as we go and
hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, we were able to hook up once or twice and really talk things through, but we weren't able to do any kind of sample art together to see what the end product was. Our first sample experimental art together was issue one, and it worked out. So
yeah,
and it's odd things that, like, with the darkening that I don't like when I see it in the print comic, look perfectly fine when I look at the digital comic version on the iPad, and I can't tell the difference. So it's, obviously I overthink these things. And I definitely, as Brian's always pointing out, I care about little details that no one else will ever see. But
do you guys, are you guys ever afforded the time between
time
right? Okay, I can see where this is going, but I'll finish the question anyway. Between when the issues come out and when the collection comes out, do you get a chance to make like minor color tweaks and stuff like that, or is it just typos that you're able to catch?
It's pretty much just typos that we have time for. We don't have the budget to pay Nick to do more coloring, so we can't do that really. But even if we could, I don't think we have the time really, because by the time the trade goes to print on this, we're already neck deep in whatever the next thing is that we're doing. I'm finishing up the post-production artwork for this week. I'm also doing some artwork for another unrelated Robo project that I don't think we're supposed to talk about yet. And then I now, on top of everything, I just got some artwork requests for the RPG we're working on, which I had not forgotten about, but I'd completely forgotten that I was going to have to dedicate a large chunk of time towards creating new art for this. And so that just fell in my lap.
And free comic book day.
And something we're doing for Comixology. And
you have to do it all this week, and it's already Tuesday.
Yes. So to answer your question, no, there is no time to ever go back and change things. someday when Brian and I are sitting atop the Robo Empire, looking down from our lofty height, just, you know, surveying domain, laughing maniacally, cackling, then I will have time. I will have hired a team of underpaid teenage artists who I have forced to draw exactly like I do, and I will just art direct them and make nitpicky little changes to everything they do. But right now, that's not an option.
You really think about that, don't you?
Yeah, so much, yes.
So the She-Devils basically destroyed an island installation that the Japanese had. And previous issue, there was an abandoned base or something, but this sort of implies that they did, in fact, inhabit some island spaces and weren't completely mobile the entire time. Would you say that that's probably the last installation of this Japanese army? And now they've just, you know, everything's been pulled in, and now this assault on San Francisco Bay is about to happen, and this is all the forces? Or are we still going to be seeing more disenfranchised Imperial Japanese dissidents out there?
My prediction is that we won't see those soldiers. We will possibly see Dr. Dinosaur getting their technology, because there's bound to be another South Pacific island with at least something left over.
And the original Dr. Dinosaur confrontation was in the South Pacific, right?
That is correct. Yeah. What was he doing there?
Something with crystals.
Whoa. But yeah, if we were ever to come back to this, it'll be what, like how many decades in the future?
Oh, it'll be a long time.
Yeah. These pages were a lot of fun to draw. Page 10 through 16 or so, I guess.
It's always fun to see
pretty
the
much
devils doing stuff.
It really is, yeah. It's fun to draw them doing stuff.
Yeah, they all have a lot of personality, visual.
Reminds me, I need to write their little bios for the trade. I do like the page with the stupid doctors on page 9. But it was like a weird mix of, like, it reminded me of working with Lewis and Martin again. And to a certain degree, it was also sort of the Dr. Dinosaur with the these lights are only for ambiance kind of moment.
So then on page 16, the battle at San Francisco Bay starts 5 days later. We've got...
That was a weird... I felt that was a weird cut. I mean, we had to do it. Yeah, we had to do it because of, you know, travel time and so on.
Yeah.
And we're really vague on exactly how far all this She-Devil stuff in the South Pacific, you know, which the South Pacific is huge, you know,
yeah.
So which corner was that? So we just kind of generically, 5 days of travel later. It
right.
Just, I don't know. It just feels kind of rushed. Like, but at the same time, there's no other way to do it because it would just have been boring to do anything in between.
I think it worked okay.
It reads fine, but just to me, I don't know.
Yeah. With the space we had available, I think we were sort of forced to do it this way. Page 17, panel 2. That is like my favorite panel ever.
which panel is your favorite panel ever?
For now, panel 2 on page 17, where the Japanese, the bucket heads get jumped by the She-Devils.
You feel like you've finally gotten to where you understand how they look and how you can...
Mostly. I've actually, again, I've changed these things subtly as the issue's gone by also. There's never enough time for the pre-production on things like this, so you're constantly revising a little bit as you go.
Yeah.
So I've made minor modifications to them, but I just liked it because it's a very small panel, and I like drawing things really small. So it was fun to just draw these little dudes at the scale that I prefer, like that I would doodle them in the margins of the page at. And that's usually where you get, for me anyway, that's where I get the most motion and action going on.
And now you draw it actual size, right?
Yeah, yeah. So how it is in the comic book is that is the size I drew it at. And it's a pretty small panel with a lot going on in it. And I just I like that.
That sort of thing works well with your style because you're not exactly abstract, but you know you're not as obsessed with line as other quote unquote photorealistic comic book artists are. You have a slightly more cartoony-ness to your stuff. So when you shrink it down like this and you put in a bunch of, explosion stuff, it creates the illusion of even more detail than what you actually put in.
Yes, and I like that. Like that's what's always so appealing about like concept artwork. Brian's constantly sending me giant robots and stuff from the internet that are these concept paintings that are like 3 or 4 sloppy strokes with a brush. And
they look amazing.
It's like just the idea of a robot. Yeah. And, of course, and your imagination is filling in all the gaps and making it look cool. And it's kind of the same effect here.
Like if you actually drew it,
it would look terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This doesn't even work. What?
Yeah, exactly. But when you can't see the joints in the initial sketch, it must work, right?
Yeah.
Because there it is. But I really like that. I like the big panel where the she-devils come swooping down.
That is definitely the panel of this series.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And this is actually one of several instances of sort of the Japanese style shining sun motion lines kind of shots in here.
Yeah, I really like this effect. I mean, regular speed lines are fine, but I like this kind of like it's a little more graphic. And again, like Brian was saying, it's a little more abstract. And I just kind of like that. You can interpret it as sunshine. You can interpret it as motion lines. Whatever it is, it adds just a neat
energy
effect to the page and energy to the page. I was really happy with that. And this whole page, I was really happy with. Like just the bottom panel with the over-the-shoulder shot from one of the She-Devils looking down on the Hida and the burning wreckage of the little bucket head on the flight deck and things like that. I really love stuff like that. I could draw like this all day long.
But I won't let you.
No, but he won't let
me. Or you have to do another boring conference call.
I also love every time Lauren and Robo are yelling at each other. You do a great angry Lauren.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun.
On page 20, you get there's an interesting thing. There's where there's a panel where Takeshi, I guess it's sort of a this sort of invisible glance in one of the Foo Fighters. I guess it's like it's basically a transparent panel. Essentially,
yes, I know what you're talking about. It's panel 4, and he's talking to the admiral back on the Hida. Yeah, initially in my head,
was it scripted?
In the script, no, the initial script kind of envisioned much more like
he's
tangible,
practically like in a mechanical womb, just really packed in there.
Yeah, and he was supposed to be wearing goggles with all these wires and tubes coming out of them. But then I figured, well, you wouldn't be able to see his expressions if he was. It would just be a mouth hanging out the bottom of all this cool headgear. So I talked it over with Brian, decided to kind of do one or two shots like this where you're sort of looking through the mech at the pilot inside. Shiro does that a lot in Appleseed where when the characters are in the landmates where you'll kind of get an inside view, and it's very much the way like they do Tony Stark when he's inside the Iron Man suit, but they want to show his face. Same idea, basically. The only problem with it is for those to work really well, with Tony Stark in the movie anyway being a perfect example, it's a super close-up on him. And you can't do a super close-up and fit the dialogue into the panel, so you have to kind of fudge things and figure out different ways of doing it. But the idea is basically the same. I do like drawing Robo when he interacts with Takeshi. I just like Takeshi, though, because Robo is so kind of flippant and he's not a very serious person. And this guy is so driven by his sense of honor and duty and his responsibilities. Like, I like the juxtaposition of the two of them.
Something I guess we kind of glanced over is the huge reveal that the Supercarrier Hida has an electrogravity drive installed, like we mentioned earlier.
Oh, yeah. Why wouldn't you?
You guys have had so much to say about this insane Japanese technology in the past. I was wondering, Tesla, I assume this is also a Tesla-inspired innovation here?
There's been sort of theories proposed and chased after for some time, linking the electromagnetic spectrum and electromagnetic waves to gravity. Basically, Tesla was involved in some of this, but mostly it's known by Thomas Townsend Brown. There were some experiments done in the military using this effect. It's never really been proven, though. It's one of those weird things where the math almost works if you look at it right. But it's mostly useful as a just neat sci-fi idea.
Well,
with,
but as we
with
all
like
know,
a
next
slight ground reality.
next year we get our Back to the Future hoverboards, don't we?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Mattel was finally got past that lawsuit that we all heard about in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good, good.
Would this be the same things that the U.S. government was looking into when they were attempting to develop their own flying saucers during the 1950s?
Okay, so you know you have your crazy, oh, they're testing alien technology theories. Those are just obviously bullshit.
Right.
But those were partly...
Wait, what?
Yeah, sorry, Scott, there's no such thing.
Oh, man.
But they were slightly promoted by the U.S. government because it distracted from the real truth that they were looking into these other forms of propulsion. One of the more sane theories of, you know, what kind of propulsions are they experimenting with was electrogravity, whether or not they actually were, or whether or not if they did anything even remotely useful came out of it is kind of questionable. But yes.
This is one of those panels that made me cry a little bit when I was trying to figure out how to do it.
The one with the Hita coming up?
Yeah, well, because the Hita, again, was you'd think the Hita's a fairly important piece of the puzzle, but when it came to doing the original designs, I really just did a little sketch of it and said, all right, that's all I have time for on this. And then as I was drawing the issues, I was like, oh, this is stupid. I should kind of change this a little bit. Oh, I don't like that. And then when we got here, I'm like, okay, how can I radically change this thing so that I don't hate drawing it? It doesn't look like a big fat sea cucumber. And then I said, oh, you have to blow. This is a one-way trip for these guys, probably. You have to blow off these ablative plates to expose the electric drive.
I was just going to ask about that.
That was once again me finding creative ways to change things and be lazy. So, yeah, all these panels and plates have to come flying off. And that generator you were talking about in the first panel would kind of be just, you know, just behind the bow plate that doesn't come off.
Right.
I really loved Nick's colors on this panel where the Hita finally takes off.
Yeah.
I think here we were really kind of starting to hit the sweet spot of what I was looking for from him. Like the really subtle texture in the sky and in the water. There's green and red and gray on the ship, but it's all very, very subtle. It's perfect. I have to remember to this out.
Do that.
You do this everywhere, please. But again, that's actually a fairly small drawing of this thing. And it just came from a little doodle that I'd done down in the margin of the page and said, oh, if I can just make that happen exactly the same way, twice as large up here. I must have drawn this panel 5 or 6 times. I remember bitching to Brian about it. Of course, every day I bitch about whatever I'm drawing to him, so he won't remember.
I hate you, Brian. I hate your scripts. I hate your drawing.
Well, I had almost erased a hole through my page because I started over so many times. I was about to just shred it and actually grab a new piece of Bristol. And that was when I had the idea to blow off the panels and expose the engine and whatnot. So like on the Buckethead mechs, they're mostly smooth hulls, but then you have these kind of, you can see the kind of the raw engine stuff kind of underneath, and then you kind of get the same look happening in the Hita now. So I was very happy to figure that out. It was a very special moment. And then I realized on the next page that I had to suddenly figure out how to draw this from behind and below. And said, oh, crap, I don't know. The money shot is the 3/4 front view, okay?
Yes.
The rest of it's all just, it's good enough.
I'd say the money shot really here is the last panel of the issue, the moment everyone's been waiting for, which is Robo with a big honking jetpack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have designed, like, so many jetpacks for him. I have to scan them all and add them to the trade if we can find room. So many stupid jetpacks for him. I just couldn't figure out anything that would look good. Because he's so heavy, we wanted to have something that was like... And it's supposed to be built from the wreckage of his aircraft. So
right.
It's got to be kind of ridiculously large. And I looked at everything from the vertical takeoff experiments done in the 50s by the Air Force. So it's like they had manufactured like one-man helicopter backpacks. They had these flying platforms.
Those are really cool, though.
The bells, that they look cool, but drawing them, so it's like a disc. Okay, so in Johnny Quest, the opening of Johnny Quest,
right?
If anyone wants to Google this, these guys have these little hovering discs that they're on with handlebars, basically, and those existed. And the real version of them looks way cooler because it's very clunky and much more functional looking. It doesn't have that goofy
60s.
That 60s design aesthetic. It's just like, okay, here's a giant fan with some sticks for legs and a basic cage to hold you in, and you stand on top of these spinning blades and hope you don't fall in. It was amazing. It was the idea of then drawing that in dynamic ways with Robo on it became, I did a bunch of tests and it was so hard to make it look good consistently that I scrapped that idea. And then there was a real jetpack that would have been perfect for him, except it was basically a jet turbine engine. So a big round kind of donut thing perched on your back at an angle, like a 45-degree angle sticking out from your back. And over your shoulders came these massive intake pipes. And it was just so bad. The thing looked like it was designed for Robo. And it had his same kind of like fat, chunky, round lines and whatnot. And it was aesthetically, it was perfect. But because it was so bulky, he would be unable to do anything cool while wearing it. Because in the test I did, he kind of ended up looking like the little brother from Christmas Story when he's out in his snowsuit and he can't move. I like what we finally ended up. I've been looking a lot at Alex. I'm going to say his name now. Milne, the guy who's drawing a Transformers series right now called More Than Meets the Eye. And he is really good at technology and making robots emote. He's really, really good at it. So I've been stealing everything I could from him. I feel like I learned a lot from studying his stuff. And this is probably the first and only – Brian and I always talk about having Robo with a big 50 caliber machine gun and just it looking really cool. But then visually, the 50 cal is kind of weird to draw and look at. Like it's a little – it's sort of strange proportion-wise. I mean, not for what it is, but to be used as a handgun, it doesn't really work so well.
Yeah.
But I think everything worked out okay in this panel. I was pretty happy with it.
Yeah, here we are. Yep. I mean, it's completely awesome. And
this whole reveal on the last page is – it's really cool.
Still more kind of Nick and I trying to find the right vocabulary to express it. Like, let's put some color here. Let's put some color there with the technology. But I think it works pretty well. I like how he's kind of reflected the orange of the She-Devil's jetpacks in the cowling cover of this one, and the little wings. I'm going to be sad to like move on to the next one just because the way the blues and the oranges work in this very South Pacific set story are just like so pretty. I don't want to. What are we doing next? Is it Hollow Earth next after the little projects?
Yeah,
it's gonna be.
You're allowed to say that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. I know. Everyone knows. Okay. Savage Sword of.
Where else are you going to set the Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur?
Exactly. That has to be in Hollow Earth, right?
Awesome.
Although for me now, that looks like it's like three stories away. We have to do the 2000. We've got to do Free Comic Book Day and then the Comixology thing. Although that'll be exciting doing the now I don't remember which one's which, but we're gonna introduce a new villain.
You changed it, and
I know, right?
Which one was which.
But we're gonna introduce a new villain to the Robo Rogues Gallery.
That's exciting. Are you guys allowed to talk about whatever the quote Comixology thing is?
I don't think so.
Don't know. We're doing something with them. That's I think all we can say. Okay. it will be an original Robo story, and it will be cool.
There will be an explosion.
Yes, something will get punched.
Robo might get damaged.
He might say applesauce.
Wow, you just filled up my bingo card there.
Man, it just occurred to me that the Robo bingo card would just be incredibly depressing. Because, it's funny because it's true. Oh.
Well, you guys were at New York Comic Con recently.
Oh, yeah.
And signing together, doing stuff. Anything cool happen there?
Yeah, that was cool.
I don't remember anything.
That show is a blur every single time. It's so big and overwhelming, but it's also – it's a really great show for us to do because we see a ton of people while we're there, a lot of fans. But it's a weird show in that I think it's the only show where we actually have to commute back and forth to the show. So yeah. We spent so much time traveling that we never really get to like hang out and socialize like you normally would at a con. So mm-hmm. It's a very long day of work with a very long commute on either side because I live in the city and Brian, and sometimes he stays with me, but we have no kitchen right now. So he's staying with our friend Frank in Brooklyn and his commute not any shorter from there. So it's an exhausting convention, but it was really good. We met tons and tons of people. We sold a couple of comic books. We met the woman who is going to do the Helen cosplay, Robo's girlfriend from Volume 5. She is friends with the guy who made the Robo costume. And
Featherweight?
She was saying, yes. Yeah. And she was saying that she was going to try and convince him to come with her next year, both of them in cosplay.
Which would be amazing.
Kind of awesome to see.
Yeah, that would be very awesome. Very, very awesome.
Not going to lie.
No one else will have a booth bot.
No, we'll be the only ones with a booth bot.
Do you guys have any other appearances forthcoming?
Yeah, well, let's see. We're doing a signing at Midtown Comics at the end of November.
November 30th at 6:30.
Which location, though? I don't remember.
They have not told me, but it will be at a Midtown Comics.
A Midtown Comics. Okay. We will be doing, or I will be doing a signing for the trade when it comes out at Bergen Street Comics in Brooklyn.
Oh, that's cool.
Which, if you can get up for, that'd be neat. But that might be a little travel in a short period of time.
So, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah. Which I, you know, there's a lot, there's many great comic shops in New York City. And I have two really good ones here on Staten Island, Comic Book Jones and one of the Jim Hanley's branches. But I love going to Bergen Street because it's like a bookstore. And I just really appreciate that. It kind of takes comics to like an adult level, where you walk in and you don't feel like you're in a comic shop, which sounds like it's a diss to other comic shops, but it's not. It's just kind of it's the kind of place where as a comic book creator, I want to really hang out. Whereas a lot of other comic book shops are like, as a fan, I want to go to hang out, but I don't know. I feel like a big boy when I go to Bergen Street. Yeah, it's organized really well. They have and they get a lot of really interesting material into their store just because of their where they're located and the clients, the kind of people who shop there are more interested in that stuff. So they get a lot of really great foreign books, and I just drool over all the art in those because it's funny. You leave America and go to like France or Spain, and the comics that they're creating are just these incredible works of art. They come at it from a very different perspective, I think.
You know, they don't even care about Blackest Night.
Really? That is unacceptable.
I know.
Were they not excited about DC 52?
Probably not.
God, French.
Oh my God. You mean they are just not all over AVX?
You know what? Every time someone says that, this is the first time someone has said AVX and I've known what you were talking about.
What about Avengers versus X-Babies?
Well, that one, that's different.
with your pals, Guri.
Oh, Guri Hero. Wait, they're doing an X-Babies comic?
They did it like a cover.
Oh.
No, they did the entire issue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's Scotty Young scripted it all, but they drew all the interiors.
That would be sweet, because I picked up all the Power Pack issues that they did. And yeah, the stories were just so much fun and so ridiculous and so well drawn that they were just amazing. They were just so much fun to read, and I really, really enjoyed them. And it's always awesome to find a mainstream comic where you can still get excited like that. Their art is super cool.
If you guys want to check out more Atomic Robo, all you got to do is go to atomic-robo.com. You can buy all the issues for dirt cheap in digital format on Comixology and other fine digital comic retailers, or schlep on down to a store and demand your print issues because you love killing them trees. And they got Atomic Robo skate decks. The Atomic Robo RPG is, as you heard, in development, so that's cool. And look forward to the collected version of Atomic Robo Real Science Adventures coming out sometime in November. That's an anthology collection all written by Brian with various artists working on different stories all throughout the timeline of the Roboverse.
I did the
covers.
And
it's cool. And shut up. No one cares about the covers.
What else, guys? What else do you want to plug?
We just make these comics. We don't understand what happens after that.
No, they go somewhere and then people get them, but I don't know how that works.
No. Neither does Diamond. Hey! No!
Anyway, look forward to the next episode of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts coming out when Atomic Robo Volume 7, Issue 5 comes out, and the epic finale of the She-Devils of the Pacific. And then what's to come afterwards with Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts? Well, time will tell. Maybe we'll go back and we'll cover some of the previous volumes, or maybe you'll see us again when Volume 8 starts up.
I would like to point out that we did not snicker once when you said nuts and bolts this time.
I was really holding back.
I know. You were good.
I had to mute the mic.
Bye, I'm Cap.
I'm Brian.
I'm Scott.
See you next time.
Nuts and bolts.
I got a rocket in my pocket and a roll in my wall. With the North 40 tone, there ain't nothing you can tell me I don't already know. I got a rocket in my pocket and I'm ready to go. Let's go someplace so we can rock a bit. I
got a rocket in my pocket and a fuse lit.
Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts is brought to you by Nerdy Show. If you somehow enjoyed what you've heard, you can show your support by telling a friend or going to nerdyshow.com and clicking the support button. Even a small contribution gets you cool nerdy perks, possibly crystals, and allows you to take part in our monthly support drive contests. For more episodes of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts, videos, contests, and other nerdy programming, visit nerdyshow.com. Subscribe to all the Nerdy Show Network's latest episodes via the iTunes Store, and remember to follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Nerdy Show and Dr. Dinosaur. For all Atomic Robo news, go to atomic-robo.com, a highly inefficient URL.
My pajama fights are very serious. My cape has changed. It's dramatic.
That is not my baby, Maury.
I totally drew a nice robo poster thing. I just need to finish it.
Does he got clothes on or is he topless?
He's topless. He's got clothes on in all the other ones, so I wanted to show off his sexy chest.
That was a good instinct.
I was thinking a little Will Riker chest curl going on there. Perhaps maybe a beard.
I like it. And give him glasses.
Ooh.
One of those newsboy hats.
My God, he looks like me.
Oh, shit. Hell? Revealed only my fetish.
Not as sexy, but close.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Brian.
Ooh. My radio voice is ready.
Hooray.
Really? Oh, Lord, what comic book do we work on?
I don't know.